All right, go ahead and open your Bibles to Daniel chapter 11. Yesterday I had the privilege of I guess you'd say marrying Davis and Katie. And Kathy and I had the opportunity to counsel them as they prepared for marriage. And I will say we didn't have very much counseling to do. They'd spent quite a bit of time thinking about this thing. And I think they had about 4 years to prepare their minds and their hearts for it. But we had a good time just talking with them. It was very interesting in a lot of the conversations that we'd have. And knowing them since they were little, that kind of made it a little more unique. But I don't know if you've been watching the news this past week, but you've probably seen that our government is full of a lot of intrigue. Have you ever noticed that? Have you ever noticed that there's a lot of intrigue going on? Well, as we look at these verses in Daniel, especially through this latter part of chapter 11, we're going to be witnesses to intrigue. And that's what this chapter is about, especially this particular part, and as it moves into the end. And that's the political intrigue that would put our modern-day politicians to shame. None of them can compare with the man that we're going to talk about today. So take a look at the verses there with me. If you remember, the king is now dead. He has died. And his son has taken over for him. And if you look there at verse 20... in his place, one will rise who will send out a tax collector. So this is the son of Seleucus, and he sends out this son, and his son sends a tax collector out for the glory of the kingdom. But within a few days, he'll be shattered. It's actually a few years, but because it was such a short time, it's called here a few days. He'll be shattered, though not in anger or in battle. So he will not die in battle. He will not die in anger. He'll simply be killed. In his place, a despised person will arise. Royal honors will not be given to him, but he will come during a time of peace and seize the kingdom by intrigue. A flood of forces will be swept before him, and they'll be shattered as well as the covenant prince. And after an alliance is made with him, he will act deceitfully. He will rise to power with a small nation. During a time of peace, he will come into the richest part of the province and do what his fathers and predecessors never did. He will lavish plunder, loot, and wealth on his followers, and he'll make plans against fortified cities, but only for a time. The interesting thing here is, as we work through these verses, you'll notice that this is a frequent theme in this particular part, and it repeats this phrase, for a time, or in its time, or in the time. So we realize here that what God is telling us is, even though these men are men of intrigue, God is the one who controls what is happening. So nothing happens outside of his time. With a large army, he will stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south, and the king of the south will prepare for battle with an extremely large and powerful army. But he will not succeed, because plots will be made against him. Those who eat his provisions will destroy him. His army will be swept away, and many will fall slain. The two kings whose hearts are bent on evil will speak lies at the same table, but to no avail. Seems like nothing really changes, does it? For still the end will come at the appointed time. The king of the north will return to his land with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the holy covenant. And he will take action, then return to his own land. At the appointed time, he will come again to the south, but this time will not be like the first. Ships of Kittim will come against him, and being intimidated, he will withdraw. Then he will rage against the Holy Covenant and take action. On his return, he will favor those who abandon the Holy Covenant. His forces will rise up and desecrate the temple fortress. They will abolish the daily sacrifice and set up the abomination of desolation. With flattery, he will corrupt those who act wickedly toward the covenant, but the people who know their God will be strong and take action. Those who are wise among the people will give understanding to many, yet they will die by sword and flame and be captured and plundered for a time. And when defeated, they will be helped by some, but many others will join them insincerely. Some of the wise will fall so that they may be refined, purified, and cleansed until the time of the end, for it will still come again at the appointed time. So this new ruler that's described in verse 20 is Antiochus the Great's son, Seleucus IV. And when he was king, he sent out a tax collector named Heliodorus. And this tax collector, if you recall, Antiochus the Great had a problem, and that problem was that Rome put him under tribute. And as a result of this tribute, he had to collect vast sums of money. And if you remember, when he went to the Temple of Zeus to collect money from the temple and steal money from the temple, the people rose up and basically killed him. So here his son is continuing to have to pay this tribute to Rome, and so he sends this tax collector to collect this money. Eventually, Heliodorus would come back, and then he would kill Seleucus, and then he would seize the throne for himself. The interesting thing was Seleucus had a son, and this son was a hostage in Rome, but he had a brother, and the brother we're going to talk about here is Antiochus Epiphanes, and he's the man that rises from among the people and is not given honor. Take a look at verse 21 there, and I want you to notice how he rises to power, because when he comes to power, he comes with intrigue. He comes deceitfully. After Heliodorus seized the throne, Antiochus convinced the Romans to allow him to leave Rome and instead put Demetrius, his nephew, in chains or in confines. And so Demetrius, who was the heir to the throne, was kept back in Rome while Antiochus goes to Syria to depose Heliodorus with the aim of bringing Demetrius back to power as the actual king. But once he got to Syria, he convinced several different kings to join him, and they managed to take possession of the crown and get rid of Heliodorus. But you see, no one suspected anything, because one of the things that Antiochus had learned while in Rome was how to convince people to do what he wanted to do. And it was one of his particular gifts is that he was very astute at watching other people. And so while he was there in Rome, he wasn't actually in chains. He was a prisoner at what they called at large. And so he would spend all of his time watching the senators, watching the elected officials of that time take bribes and convince other people to do what they wanted to do in exchange for money. So he was an astute student of this. And when he eventually came to power, he used that gift that he had to convince other people to do what he wanted them to do. Notice in verse 21 that because of his action, he's despised by the people. Now, when he comes to power, he actually gives himself the name Antiochus Epiphanes, which means Antiochus the Illustrious One. And he actually, as he grew in power, began to use the term meaning Antiochus the God. Antiochus the Illustrious One, Antiochus the Almighty. But the people there, the subjects of the kingdom, called him Antiochus Epimenes, or Antiochus the Insane. And one of the reasons they did that is because he acted in a very peculiar manner. They were certainly appalled by the fact that he had stolen the throne, but they were very incensed by the fact that he always acted very unkinglike. He was very unregal in his way of acting. And a contemporary account describes his habit of wandering among the common people beneath the dignity of a king. Listen to what this contemporary person said about him. He often lounged like a mere idler about the streets of Antioch. He would engage in idle and trifling conversation with the lowest of people and mingle in the society of men of the vilest character. He was not ashamed to drink and carouse with them, and without the least regard to the dignity of his station and character, not infrequently he was seen drunk in the streets. Look again there at verse 21, and you'll see that he came during a time of peace, and he seized the throne entirely by intrigue. Rod and I were reminiscing a few moments ago about the golden age of television, the golden age of movies. And during that period of time, one of my favorite actors was prominent on the screen. And that man's name was Howard Morris. And Howard Morris played various parts in several different movies. If you've ever seen the movie The Horse Soldiers, he plays a drunken Confederate. And if you've seen the movie Shenandoah, he plays an engineer of a northern train that's eventually burned by Jimmy Stewart. But the character that you will remember him by is a character who would always enter the scene with a refrain, and he would say, "It's me, it's me, it's Ernest T." And Ernest T had a habit when he would appear on the scene is he would throw rocks at people. You remember that? And he would throw rocks at people's windows. Well, one of the things that Antiochus did that really teed people off is he would wander the streets with his robes, and under his robes he had a bag, and in that bag were rocks, and he would throw rocks at people. And so people would look at him and say, "What is wrong with this guy? He's absolutely crazy." And so they would look at him and they would call him Antiochus the madman. But look at verses 22 through 24, and I want you to notice there a divine appointment. If you want to have a visual of Antiochus, just think of Ernest T., and you've got the picture there. That's what this guy is like. But look at particularly at verse 22 through 24, and you'll notice that his military prowess would be totally miraculous. And one of the reasons for that is the fact that he knew nothing about the military. Not only did he not know anything about the military, he had no support from the military or from the people. Everyone thought he was absolutely crazy. But he was able to come to power by a miracle. And that miracle was God's interaction with what was going on. You see, that's the thing about God, isn't it? He often brings people to power who are absolute idiots. Have you ever noticed that? Have you ever looked at politicians sometimes? And have you ever noticed that? Sometimes I look at them and say, "How did you ever get there?" And we have to summarize that it had to be by God's authority. You remember earlier in the book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar confessed that. He said that God raises up people to be rulers. And sometimes God raises the basis of men up. And sometimes it's because of our ignorance. But look again at verses 22 through 24, and I want you to notice here that whole armies are going to be swept before him. And look particularly at the verse there, and you'll notice that there's something there that's a key, and that is that he would do what even his father was unable to do. And what all the previous rulers in front of him were not able to accomplish, not even Alexander the Great. And he actually styled himself, so did his father, Antiochus the Third. He styled himself as another Alexander. And so these whole armies would be swept before him. And look particularly at verse 22 through 23, and you'll see that the Bible begins to describe another person here who is his nephew through his sister Cleopatra. And this person is Ptolemy the Sixth. And Ptolemy at this time wanted to come against Antiochus, but Antiochus came down with a larger army and looked at him and said this to him. He said, "What we're going to do is we're going to join forces. We're going to work together here. And because remember, we are family." You remember that big line, "We're family"? And so he would look at him and he would say, "Don't worry, Ptolemy, I'll tell you what, you just hang out with me. Don't even worry about governing Egypt. You don't need to govern Egypt, just hang out with me and I'll take care of you. By the way, you can kind of hang out in one of these cities and you'll be good. But I'm going to watch over you." Antiochus totally destroyed the army of Ptolemy and then he took him hostage in 169. But look what happens here in verse 22. So this whole flood of forces are swept away before him, and they're shattered. And then look what the Bible says about that. The covenant prince is also shattered. And this covenant prince is this nephew of his, this Ptolemy the Sixth. But notice here in particular that something begins to happen. As he begins to covenant with his uncle, he begins to make plans to regain his throne, because while he's under the power of his uncle, the Syrians decide, or the Egyptians rather, decide that what they're going to do is they're going to put his brother, the other son of Cleopatra, in charge of the kingdom. And that man is Ptolemy the Seventh. And Antiochus agrees to help Ptolemy regain his throne, but only as a puppet of the Syrians. But look at verse 23 and notice that Gabriel tells Daniel that Antiochus's rise to power would seem insignificant. It would be made with a very small number of people, and this would be because it's totally by divine power. As he came to power, he came with a very few people, a very few supporters. And most of these supporters were people that he had bought, that he had paid off. He greased the skids. And at first, he seemed like a small power. But as he grew in power and influence, wherever he went, he outdid what his fathers had done. So here's this man. He's a small man. He's a man of very small power. But God begins to bless that small power because he's going to use him in a unique way. And that sometimes is an encouragement to me as I look at some of these people that are in power and authority. And I look at what they do and I watch what they do and I think to myself, why has God placed that person there? And I began to watch what's going on. And if you study history and you study politics and you watch these people, you can learn a lot of what God is trying to do to his people and with his people. So it can actually be something that you can turn in your favor. The writer of the first book of Maccabees said this, that in the liberal giving of gifts, he outdid the kings that were before him. And you see, because he came to power through deceit and bribery, his power would be very weak. Have you ever noticed when somebody has to bribe people to support them that their authority is very weak? Ever been around someone like that, that the only way they get people to like them is to flatter them? But inside, there's always a turmoil going on because they're not comfortable with themselves. Look at verse 24, and I want you to notice here that Antiochus is able to influence the people through these gifts, and his plans of conquest would be maintained for a very short time. This would be a very, very short time until his true nature was revealed, and then the end decreed for him would come to pass. So his power was very, very short-lived. And notice in these verses that there is a parallel here between Antiochus the Great and and the Antichrist. And as you look at these verses, as we read through them, you probably noticed some of those things that began to spark something within you which said, this kind of sounds like Antichrist. Because you see, Antichrist will also come on the scene by subduing nations through flattery and distribution of wealth and military power. But when he comes on the scene at his appointed time also will be what? Very, very short. And so it's an encouragement to know that even though these people come on the scene and they come to power and their power is very, very destructive, God is in total control. But I want you to notice there in verse 25 through 28 that a troubling time begins to occur in the life of this man. And I want you to notice first that Antiochus demonstrates his power through military might. You see, this man, because he's a man of deception, lacks courage. Look at verse 25. And he has to gain his courage and respect by flexing his military might. You see, one of the characteristics of a weak ruler or a weak person is they have to show their power through force. You ever watched a parent who loses their temper and shows their power through force? You ever witnessed that? Have you ever been that parent? Sure. Because we finally lose control. And we show that we don't have control at that moment. And this was the kind of person that Antiochus was. Within, he was very unsure of himself. And so what he would do is he would come against anyone who disagreed with him, anyone who looked like they were a threat to him, and he would begin to flex his military might. Someone once said this, only little men use power to gain respect. And you see, that's the kind of ruler Antiochus was. He was a little man in a big man's body. In World War II, there was a nobody from the cotton fields of Texas who was a very, very small man. And this man became, he was actually initially rejected when he tried to join the service, partly because he was underage, but the other part was because he was underweight, because he was so small. And they said, no, we don't need men like you. We want real men. We don't want little men. But he was able to convince his sister to lie about his age, and he was able to enlist. I kind of imagine he may have had weights in his shoes to help him It reminds me of a scene, I don't know if you ever watch Andy Griffith, but the time that Barney had to pass the examination to continue in his position, but he was underweight. And so Andy had the bright idea of making his identification tags extra large to give him a little extra weight. And he was able to make it. But you see, this man, even though he was initially rejected, became a household name and one of the heroes of World War II. And while in the army, this man was often ridiculed by his fellow soldiers because of his small size. They would look at him and they would say, "You're nothing." And they would laugh at him and make fun of him. But they didn't know that one day they would actually owe their lives to his courage. Because you see, this was a little man or a big man in a little man's body. And Audie Murphy, as we'll see through the remaining verses here, was a person who had a strong character. Audie Murphy, this man of World War II, was a big man in a little man's body. Someone once said, he was in a bar and he was a little man and he looked at a big guy and the big guy was picking on him and he said, "Dynamite comes in very small packages." The guy picked him up and threw him in a corner and he said, "Explode." So sometimes being a big man in a little man's body doesn't always work. But as we work through the remaining verses, we're going to see that there's a second characteristic of a person with a weak character, and that's a propensity to lose their temper and to strike out against everyone who gets in their way. Take a look at verse 25 through 27, and I want you to notice the intrigue that begins to occur in this family of deception. You ever notice how some sins tend to follow a family? You ever notice that? This is a family of deception. Deception follows the people in this family throughout their lives. It goes from the uncle to the father to the son to the aunt. Everyone is a person of deception in this family. Take a look at it there. Notice particularly in verse 25 through 28, the power play between Antiochus and the king of the south. I'm going to read it to you. Follow along with me. "With a very large army, he'll stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south. And the king of the south will prepare for battle with an extremely large and powerful army." This is Ptolemy the VII. "But he will not succeed because plots will be made against him, and those who eat his provisions will destroy him, and his army will be swept away, and many will fall slain." You see, as Antiochus comes down to Egypt, he goes against Ptolemy the VII with the plan, understood by his brother Ptolemy the VI, that he's going to give the kingdom back to him. Notice the deception. But you see, Ptolemy the VII doesn't know something about Antiochus Epiphanes, and that is he's already convinced his ministers to turn against him. So while Ptolemy the VII is coming against Antiochus, his ministers are working behind the scenes. Does that sound familiar? Does that sound familiar with what's going on today in our government? This deception, this behind-the-scene intrigue that's going on? Very, very interesting, isn't it? That in government, you always see this, you always have this intrigue, stealth, cloak and dagger. What was going on here in these verses? And so as he moves down into Egypt, the people of Egypt revolt against Antiochus the VI, and they still say, "We're going to support Antiochus the VI, or Ptolemy the VII. And they begin to plan. Look at what happens here in these verses. Take a look at the verses, what they do. They begin to meet together, and they begin to have a plan. "And while Ptolemy the VI was his prisoner, Antiochus treated him as an ally and a friend." Look at the verses there, and notice what happens. At the same time that he's planning to ruin Antiochus or Ptolemy the VII, Antiochus begins to make plans about how he's going to even cause trouble between the two brothers. Isn't it amazing? As they sit at the table, look what happens here. They sit at the table and they form this alliance that they have absolutely no intention of keeping. Because even as Ptolemy is there and he's making these promises to his uncle and his uncle's making his promises to him, they're both planning against each other. Ptolemy's planning to join his brother. Antiochus is planning to cause discord between the two brothers. So all of them are deceitful. Look at the verse there. Notice what it says. And so as they create these alliances with no intention of keeping them, Antiochus goes back to Egypt, and Ptolemy decides again to turn against Antiochus. So now Ptolemy's going to turn against him, and he allies himself with Rome. And in spite of all the plans that both leaders have made, God expresses his sovereignty over it. Look at what it says, in its time. In other words, all of this is going to happen. All of this is going to come about, but I am in total control. Nothing is going to happen. I'm not going to allow anything to happen in which I'm not in control of the whole situation. And as we move into the remaining verses, I want you to notice here in particular what begins to happen to the Jewish people. You see, the Jewish people always seem to be squeezed in a vise. Have you ever noticed that? You ever notice how they always seem to be just pulled together in a vise? If you've ever used a vise, you know what I'm talking about. When you turn that screw and you draw those jaws together and whatever is between becomes cracked. If you ever used a nutcracker and cracked a walnut, you know what I'm talking about. And so the Jews are now going to be caught between the two pinchers of this walnut crusher, and they're going to be crushed just like a nut. Take a look there at verse 28, and I want you to look at or notice in particular the stamping out of plots. You see, after plundering Egypt, Antiochus returns to Israel, to the land of Israel, and he's going to stamp out a plot. Because while he's down there, while he's busy in Egypt destroying what's going on down there and taking over Egypt, a rumor begins to spread among the Israelis, the Jews, that he's been killed. And the high priest Jason decides that what he's going to do is he's going to overthrow the high priest Menelaus, who's been put in place by Antiochus, and he's going to regain control of Jerusalem. And while he's engaged in a attack on Jerusalem, Antiochus comes charging back to the scene. Look there in particular at verse 28. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. Listen to what it says in 2 Maccabees. When the report came to the king, Antiochus began raging like a wild man and set out from Egypt and took Jerusalem. He ordered his soldiers to kill without mercy, and in 3 days, 40,000 were killed. Can you imagine that? 40,000 people in 3 days. 40,000 additional were sent into slavery in Syria. And then to further shame the Jews, Antiochus decided that what he would do is he would desecrate the temple. And so he sacrificed a pig on the altar. And then he stole the gold from the temple and entered the Holy of Holies, totally desecrating the temple. But that's not the worst of it. Look what happens here as he begins to melt down into his insanity in verse 29 through 35. You see, as he began to continue to encounter opposition, he began to lose all sense of morality and compassion. Everything was lost to him. And he began to literally fall apart as a person. Look at verse 29 through 35 and notice what happens as he begins to take action against the people of God. You see, before he was able to destroy the Jews, Antiochus again invades Egypt, because he realizes that what's going on is his nephew Ptolemy is now turning against him. And all authority and all power is beginning to slip through his fingers. And so he becomes more and more angry. Listen to what it says in verse 29 through 30. At the appointed time, he will come to the south, but this time will not be like the first. You see, when he comes down into Egypt, the two Ptolemy brothers by this time have resolved their issues and they begin to join forces to oppose him. And in a complete rage, he returns to Egypt because he says, this time I'm going to go down there and I'm going to wipe them off the face of the earth. I'm not going to make any deals with anyone. I'm not going to have sympathy with them because they're my nephews. I'm just simply going to go down there and kill them all. And so as he's going down there, he is able to take Alexandria, and he sends a fleet of ships down the coast. But look at verse 30, and I want you to notice that something happens here that stops him in his tracks. So he has this huge army. He has this huge navy. They're being very, very successful. They've just taken Cyprus. They've moved into the capital, Alexandria, and then something happens here. You see, remember that Ptolemy had requested this assistance from the ships of Kittim, or these ships from Rome. And after capturing Cyprus and Memphis and then moving into Alexandria, he was met by his old friend whom he had worked with there in Rome. And this man's name was Populius Laenas. And Leonidas presented Antiochus with an ultimatum because Ptolemy had sent to the Senate and he said, we need help. This guy is going to wipe us off the face of the earth. And if he does, he will attack you. Send us an edict that says he has to stop. And so the Roman Senate sent down an edict by this man. And the edict basically said, you will stop what you're doing. You'll remove your armies from Egypt and you'll go back to Syria and you will leave these people alone and you will not return. And so Antiochus looks at him and he says, I thought we were friends. I thought we hung out together. Don't you remember? And Leonidas looks at him and says, you've got to make a decision. And Antiochus says, I'll tell you what. How about if I go back to Syria and I'll think about it? And Leonidas says, no. And he draws a circle around him in the sand and he says, before you leave this circle, you must give me a decision or I will wipe you out. And so Antiochus, because he realizes that he has no other choice, he looks at Leonidas, he says, I'll do what you say. But the problem is he's totally humiliated in front of his army and he begins to take his anger out on the Jews. Look at the second half of verse 30 and I want you to notice what he begins to do to the people of God. Then he will rage against the Holy Covenant and take action, and on his return he will favor those who abandon the Holy Covenant. Notice there in particular what happens. He begins to take his rage out on the covenant people. These are the people who are faithful to the Scriptures, who are faithful to God. But look what happens to those who abandon the covenant. These are the people who begin to worship the Greek gods. When Antiochus actually moved into the city, he ordered his soldiers. He said, as you move into the city, attack everyone you see, kill them, have mercy on no one. Woman, child, old, doesn't matter, kill everyone. And so they move into the city and they begin to slaughter everyone they come upon. And to strengthen his hold in the region, he decides what he's going to do is he's just going to completely eradicate everyone who's Jewish. He burns every copy of the Torah that he can find. And he moves into the city and he decides what he's going to do is he's going to destroy the whole system of being a Jew. And if you know anything about the Jewish people, their whole system of being a Jew is wrapped up in the Torah, in the covenant. Everything, their whole identity is wrapped up in being a person of the law, the covenant. And so what he says, what I must do if I'm going to destroy them. Now, I want you to think about this and realize that there's a parallel about what's going on in our country today. And he says, if I'm going to destroy them as a people, what I have to do is I have to remove their reliance upon the law. I must completely eradicate this whole concept of being a Jew. And the first thing that he ordered was that all Jews had to worship Zeus. And to accomplish this, he set up a statue in the temple, a statue of Zeus that was actually in the temple, the abomination of desolation. Listen to what it says in 2 Maccabees. Not long after this, the king sent to force the Jews to abandon the customs of their ancestors and profane the temple in Jerusalem. A man could not keep the Sabbath or celebrate the traditional feast, not even admit that he was a Jew. If someone was found circumcising their child, the child was immediately killed. And in many cases, what they would do is they would take the woman and the child and they would throw them off the wall of the temple, so that they would fall the 200 or 300 feet to the bottom and die. And as the Jews then became corrupted and influenced by the flattery of Antiochus, many of them turned totally away from being a Jew and joined with him. If you can imagine that, joined with him in turning against who they are. If you can imagine that, it would be like people in World War II turning against America and joining with the Japanese and the Germans and the Italians against being an American. And so these people are turning against their own people and helping him kill the those who are faithful. But look at verse 33 and 35, 33 through 35, and I want you to notice what happens to those who are faithful. Those who are wise among the people will give understanding to many. In other words, those who are faithful will continue to give understanding to those who are living. and will teach them the law and help them to understand and cope with what's going on. Because one of the questions they're asking, these people are asking, is why doesn't God help us? Why is this happening? It's the same question we often ask today, don't we? Don't we often ask that question? Don't we look at each other and say, why does God allow this to happen? Why does God allow gay marriage to occur in our country? I mean, we're Americans after all. That shouldn't happen here. Isn't that what we often say? Isn't that what we think? Don't we look at each other and we think that in our hearts? And we say to ourselves, that shouldn't happen here. We're a Christian nation. We have more churches than anyone. We have more denominations than anyone. Someone once said once that if the only thing that ever made it to heaven, the first thing they would do is they would break it up into sections. It would be Northern Heaven, Southern Heaven, Independent Heaven, Fundamental Heaven. We have more denominations than anyone. Not picking on Baptists. But look what happens here. They begin to share. They begin to explain what's going on. And yet they also will die by the sword and by flame. One of his favorite ways to kill people was simply just to burn them up. I'll just sacrifice you by burning you up. I've shared with you before one particular family who refused to profane the Sabbath and refused to eat a swine were roasted in a frying pan, a large frying pan. That was the kind of man this guy was, this madman. But look there in verse 34, when defeated, they will be helped by some, but many others will join them insincerely. These were the ones who turned against them and betrayed their own people. And some of the wise will fall so that they may be refined, purified, and cleansed until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. And you know, as I look at all of this and I think to myself, why is this important, as I shared with you last time? Why is it important to know all of this? Does it really matter in the grand scheme of things? Yes, it does. And the reason that it matters is it helps us to understand the condition of our nation and what's going on and how we should react, how we should be wise in the way that we react to other people, especially to other Christians who have only a germ, a small nugget of the truth in their lives. As a matter of fact, it's one of the reasons that so many people have no regard, no respect at all for Christians, is because we, in fact, are not even living as Christians ourselves. You see, these very things that the Jews faced under Antiochus are totally prevalent in our culture. You see, even like the Jews at that time, many of the so-called Christians in America can become identified with the corruption, the sexual corruption, the moral corruption, the compromise that's going on in our country. It's amazing to me, one of the amazing things for me of marrying Davis and Katie yesterday was the purity of them, the purity of their lives as I've watched them grow up, the way they came up in the church. But they didn't just allow the church to become something they put on Sunday, but it was inside of them. And I would look at them as young people and I would marvel at that. To know each other for 4 years and to be close to each other for 4 years and yet to walk down that aisle in the marriage ceremony, pure before God. You see, that takes commitment. And so many Christians today, it's, so what? Who cares? After all, it's the 21st century. What difference does it really make? You'd be surprised how many Christians... A life of corruption is nothing to them. They see no problem with it. They see no problem with lying. They see no problem with profanity. They see no problem with sexual impurity. After all, God forgives because he's a God of grace. And so there's no level of maturity. There's no level of purity. And just like the Jews of the time, we're slowly losing our identity and our ability to influence the culture in which we're living. But look at verse 33 through 35, and I want you to notice that there's a small group of faithful Jews, a small group who would not allow themselves to be corrupted by the Greek culture that they were seeped in every single day. Now think about it for just a moment. In America, we can be Christians, and nobody really is going to kill us, are they? You know, we might get laughed at, and some of us are so afraid of being laughed at that if somebody just comes up to us and says, "You're a Christian? Ha ha! You believe in that?" And we're afraid to open our mouths. Let us be bold. Let us not be afraid. What do we have to be afraid of? That very person that's laughing at us wants to be a Christian themselves. But down deep in their heart, most likely they have a hurt because of some person who was a Christian or said they were, and we're not living a life of purity. And so they don't want anything to do with it. Many of us were like that, weren't we? Were you ever like that? I was. I would look at people as soon as they would come up to me and start talking to me about Christ. I'd say, "Get out of my face. Leave me alone. I don't want to hear it." They didn't know that internally I did want to hear it. Even though I was putting my hand up and saying, "No, I don't want to hear it." But down deep in my heart, there was a hunger for it. And that's what they also have. You see, all around us, we see corruption and violence and greed. And even in the church, unheard of compromise and sexual impurity and conflict. And like the Jews, we just throw up our hands and we say, "What's the use? Let's just stay home. Let's go to our church. And let's just be together." Not realizing we need to get out into the culture. And we need to resolve. Now listen to me, and I'll close with this. Now listen to me. We need to resolve in ourselves before we walk out that door. And listen to me, young people. You need to resolve in yourself that you're going to be pure. It's not on the day when you're faced with it. It's on the day you walk out that door and you say to yourself, "I am going to follow Christ. And I'm going to live a life of purity. My lips will be clean lips. My mind will be a clean mind. My ears will be clean ears. My heart will be clean. My hands will be clean. My eyes will look at clean things." You must determine that you're going to do that before you walk out that door. Because when you're faced with a situation in which you're looking or hearing or talking or surrounded by something, it's too late then. Because you'll just fall right into it just like a pig in the mud. You've got to make that determination. And we as Christians, we as older Christians, we need to make the determination that we're going to live lives of purity. Fathers, as hard as it is, you know, Paul and I were talking yesterday at the wedding reception about the difficulty it is to be a Christian parent and guide our kids without just placing a cloak of righteousness on them, and it never gets in here. Because all we do is we just put Christ on them and say, "Act this way, do this thing, don't watch this and don't listen to that, and you're good to go." Without realizing sometimes that we have to allow them to make that decision. As hard as it is as parents, and as painful as it is as parents, we oftentimes have to step back and let them make that decision. Let them make the mistake. Let them sometimes watch or listen to something that we don't necessarily want them to, and that we don't necessarily want to hear. But we have to allow them to begin to develop Christ in here. And sometimes as Christians, we're afraid of that, aren't we, as Christian parents? We're afraid. Oh, no, they just watched something with a curse word in it. And we get afraid of that, don't we? But we have to allow them to experience that sometimes, as painful as it is, and as much as I hate it myself. We have to allow them to put on Christ, and then we as parents must model that in front of them. We have to do it, folks. Listen to me. The whole country is at stake. The church, thousands, millions of souls. We have to look at those people right out there, right out that door, as people who need Christ, the same as us. And we have to remember that if we're going to be Christ for them, we've got to be Christ with more than just a coat of Christianese on us. We have to have more than just the language. We have to have the actions and the attitudes of Christ in our heart. Let's all stand. Our Father, Lord, look at us. We're your people. We claim to be your people. I claim to be yours. And you know, Father, oftentimes in my heart it's full of bitterness and anger, deceit, corruption. Cleanse me, Father. And then look at all of us, Father, and compel us, urge us, spur us, as your word says in Hebrews, to live lives worthy of Christ. Spur these young people, several of them graduating this year and next, spur them to live lives for Christ, not to waste their life, but encourage them to live lives for you. Spur them on. Help us as older Christians to live lives of integrity so that when they look at us, they can never stand up to us and say, "You hypocrite." But may we be sterling examples of the love of Christ and the actions of Christ. As your word says, put on the mind of Christ. Transform us, Father. In the beautiful name of Jesus Christ, amen.